Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we'll be celebrating the spirit of Manchester by speaking to someone who's helped shape the city in some way or other. Not always a Mancunian as such, often a guest who's moved here and made a great impression. This week I'm joined by the brilliant Mancunian poet, Tony Walsh. He's going to tell us about the lasting legacy of his poem, This Is The Place.
It's a pride poem for Manchester, and people that overlay things. Mm. So the fact that something's connected that deeply and broadly and profoundly for those reasons with people, it will always be a privilege, and I can't be churlish about that in any way.
And he'll also speak about a time he shared a drink with Paul Weller as a teenager.
He rips into like a case of 24 cans of beers and he has a swig of it, and I'm on the front row of the Apollo, empty Apollo here, and he goes, yeah, Paul, says, when you finish with that, mate, can I have the can? He just took a swig of it and he gave it us. So I can honestly say my first drink of lager was given to me by Paul Weller.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester a man whose work I've been aware of for several years now, and a man with whom I've shared the stage, me playing records, trying to get people to dance, and him mesmerising audiences with his beautiful poetry. His name's Tony Walsh. Welcome, how are you?
Hi, Clint. Yeah, I'm good, sir. Yeah, they can dance to my poems if they want, you know.
I've seen them dance to your poems.
I've seen them dance to my poems.
The world has danced or reacted to your poems. We'll talk about that in a little while, but... First things first, Tony, I know some of this stuff already, but for those that aren't familiar with your background, tell us where and when you were born.
I was born in Denton, 1965, I'm 53. My dad is Irish, Frank, from County Cavan in Ireland. My mum was English, mum passed away a few years ago. I was born in my nana's rented terraced house. My mum and dad got a terraced house up the road. You know, this was the 60s, this was pre-slum clearance, you know what I mean? They didn't have a lot of money. And my mum told me she cried when she seen the house. And I remember seeing a rat when I was three, you know what I mean? And I got very ill. It was damp. I got rheumatic fever. I was very ill when I was a kid. We got a council house from me being ill.
Wow. You
know, start with a big laugh straight away, Clint.
Yeah, no, I like it. This is what I want to paint some pictures, man. And you're on penicillin until you're like 14 or something, weren't you?
Yeah, we've not had penicillin that long. You know, we talk about World War One, and you know, it's not been around that long in human history. And it saved my life, and I took it every day till I was 14, and wow. I can still taste it now.
And what was the condition you had, or the
rheumatic fever? When I moved out about 10 years ago, I went to the doctors, and I had my heart checked because I did very well to come away without heart problems. And he looked over his glasses at me, this doctor, and he says, "That's a disease associated with poverty." I went, "Well, there you go," you know. And I was lucky to come away from that one.
What did your mum and dad do work wise?
My dad ups about labouring jobs. He drove a taxi for a while, and he cooked on a building site, and also he didn't stick in one job for long. My dad. And my mum, you know, I was the oldest of four, so that's what she did. She looked after us, but she worked in a sewing machine, machinist.
Right.
You know, at one point we had a big industrial sewing machine in our front room, and my mum was running up whatever she was running up, you know, whatever it took to bring home a butter, you know.
It rubs off on you, that being, you know, raised in a working class environment. And my dad was the same. He never had one job. He always did loads of different things.
Yeah.
And I think that's really rubbed off on the way I operate today.
My dad does very well. He's bad on his feet. He's disabled with his feet, but he always did manual jobs, you know what I mean? It's only as you get older,
yeah,
you realise what he was putting himself through to bring home a crust.
And your first love of music, would that have been through the records that your mum and dad were playing at home?
There was always a big, it looked like an old maid road radio in like the pantry. That was always on. I remember the charts. You only had a bath on a Sunday, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember the charts being on a Sunday afternoon.
We had no bath in our house. No. So we had to go to Shaw, to my granny. She had a bath. So me and my brother and sister got driven every Sunday into Shaw.
You can't tell them.
And we had an outside toilet they had to share with six other houses.
This is blimey hell. My mum had an old Dansette. Now I think about it, it wouldn't have been that old, you know, because this was still the late 60s.
Yeah.
You know, about 70, 72 before I got my hands on it. So my mum had a lot of old Beatles 7-inches and Elvis. Elvis was massive then, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, I loved
and
him.
So Elvis 40 Greatest and what have you. So I was into that stuff when I was seven, eight, you know.
And like me, you caught the punk bug when that came.
I did, yeah. You know, as a working class kid, you know, all that prog stuff wasn't speaking to me. I got time for certain heavy rock, but that wasn't talking to me either. And but you know, the glam stuff and the Bowie stuff, you can see now with hindsight how that came across to the punk thing, can't you?
Absolutely. Well, and also for those of us like yourself, you mentioned like Beatles and Elvis. I mean, to me, like Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee, all the 50s stuff that I love, because I'm 5 years older than you.
Yeah.
Nobody was doing that apart from the glam rockers. They were recreating the 50s, weren't they?
And there's a book I've got there in the house. I forget who it's by now. Simon Reynolds, I think. And he said, you know, the 70s was an art rock decade, just as punk as an interval. And he saw punk as recycled 50s riffs.
Really, yeah.
Which, you know, now you get older, you realise 56 to 76 is no time at all, 20 years. So, yeah, the punk thing, it had to get on top of the pops before it registered on my radar, 13, you know. But the Skids were a massive band for me. They were the first band that really hit me.
Yeah.
And then the Buzzcocks and then everything then.
And you'd spent a lot of time at the Apollo, didn't you, going to gigs, watching punk bands?
Yeah, well, I was too young for club gigs for a few years there, but I worked in a supermarket. I had to have any money. So I was actually okay for money as a teenager. So I was, anything new wave come through the Apollo, I'd be there. So apart from the Sex Pistols, who'd split up by then, you know, I've seen all the punk bands. I've seen the Clash and Susan the Banshees and the Damned, the Stranglers. And then that sort of second wave, like your Stiff Little Fingers and who have you.
Yeah.
We used to go down in the day and hang about at the stage door there, you know, around the back there.
Yeah.
And I never did suss. The bands weren't going to turn up till about 5 o'clock because they'd walk up in Aberdeen, you know what I mean? I'd hang about all day. And just as I was thinking of going home for my tea, you know, the Ramones would turn up or the Clash would turn up. The Jam let us into a sound check about 1980. Yeah. There was only about 25 kids there, maybe 40 kids, I don't know. They let us in and Paul Weller come on stage and he had, remember McEwen's Export with like the Cavalier on the front? He rips into like a case of 24 cans of beers and he has a swig of it. And I'm on the front row of the Apollo, empty Apollo here. And he goes, "Yeah, Paul," he says, "when you finish with that, mate, can I have the can?" He just took a swig of it and he gave it us. So I can honestly say my first drink of lager was given to me by Paul Weller.
That's
so
brilliant.
Maybe that's where I got my mojo from, you know.
I like that. Before that, how did you get on at school? Were you a clever kid? Were you a naughty kid?
I was all right. And I did well at school. And I've written poetry since I was 5 and 6 and 7 and they must have seen it in me. Miss Motter's Ed. And they have you writing about leaves and Christmas, don't they, and what have you. And I used to bring mine home. And we spent a lot of time at my nan's. I mean, nan copied them out into this writing pad. I meant to bring it today. I think it's a telephone pad from about 1970. It's got like a hippie lady on the front, you know what I mean, in like orange flares. And my nan copied them in there when I was 5 and 6 and 7. Then I must have said, can I write them in there myself? And I wrote them in there till I was like 10, 11. There's one about Muhammad Ali floating like a butterfly and all that from about, I don't know, 75. And then I carried on writing, but I didn't show anybody. So they go till I was about 10.
It's nice seeing where the journey started, isn't it? The actual first pages of your poetry sort of journey.
You know, I work with kids now, so I can see that I was pretty good at it when I was a kid, you know, but the system never really saw it in me. I didn't really do much with it at high school. You know, I wish I'd been jumping up in front of punk bands now and all that back at that age, but I didn't have the confidence, you know.
Right, okay. Well, who was it who christened you Longfella? Because that's your AKA, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm 6'5", 6'6". It's working on a few levels. There's a famous poet called Longfellow. So there's a reference to that. So like, he's a formal poet. I'm a bit more informal, you know what I mean? It's something that gets said in Ireland quite a lot. The tall guy, I give it to the Longfella.
Yeah.
So that's working for me as well. And I got a nice logo there. A mate of mine, Dave Kirkwood, did me a fantastic logo with two long legs on the double L's. You know, it's clever.
That's good.
So, there you go, Longfella.
What was your first job? You mentioned one of them before. You said you work in a bakery or something.
Oh, I did all sorts. What did I do? My dad knocked about with a scrap metal fella. And when I was about 13, I knocked about with a scrap metal fella one summer. Remember, he took a big boiler out of Kellogg's at Trafford Park. I was lugging that stuff about. And then I worked in a co-op at Crown Point there at Denton from being about, I lied about being, I had to be 14, I was 13.
Right.
So I worked there till I was 18. What else did I do? When I was at uni, I worked in Sunbless at Bredbury there. 7-hour shifts, 12-hour shifts rather, 7 days a week, 84 hours a week. I've still got bloody burns up my arms from doing
that. What was the wage for that, can you remember?
So it's all to do with tax codes, wasn't it? When you were a student, because you hadn't earned any money, you were actually all right on a student tax code. The blokes used to hate you for it. And I don't think the hourly rate was any good, but you did that many bleeding hours that you actually come out with a decent wage. You know?
And did you make sausages as well at one point?
I did, yeah. You got Wallsies there. It used to be called Wallsies. It's Walls, isn't it? But everyone goes Wallsies. Wall, apostrophe S, apostrophe F, Wallsies.
Like Wall sausage. So you made some blessed bread, you made Walls sausages. Do you still like a nice sausage butter?
Well, you
then?
Know what? I know what goes in them. And it ain't great, but I still like a sausage, but a bit of brown sauce, yeah.
That's it, yeah. Tell us a story. Before we get back onto your career stuff, you once got held up, didn't you, in a post office robbery?
I did, yeah. So I went to uni, Salford Uni, mid-80s. I dropped out of there. It wasn't for me. And I was on the dole for about 18 months in Leeds, my girlfriend. My wife now was in Leeds. And I worked on a post office counter about 88 to about 91, 92, all around South Manchester, but Withington mainly. Come in one morning and these lads had broke in overnight and they were all proper gangsters cheating me. I think
and they were waiting for you?
Waiting for us. So they had balaclavas on, guns and knives and that. And Rambo was just out as a film and he had these big Rambo knives, you know. And for a while I couldn't have talked about it, you know what I mean? I'm okay with it now.
How old were you then, sorry?
23, 24. Yeah. But I was the only young lad. There was older fellas and older women. So they kept me on my own in case I, you know, had to go back like.
Yeah, really?
So they had a big hunting knife at my throat there. And then they took us through. And it was a little, more like a little pistol thing, little starting pistol thing. And tied us up with hands behind my back. So there's a few things make me think. When you hear that sound, tape, that makes me think.
Does it? To this day?
To this day. You know, looking down the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, you've seen
that. That makes you think, you know. Incredible. But I think I've still got some, I talk about bruising. I've still got some bruising on in a stress place that when I get stressed about anything, you know, missing a bus, it presses on it. You know what I mean? It's still there.
And let's talk about your poetry. So you started writing 5, 6 year old. You didn't perform in public till really late, did you?
39. You know, I stopped writing when I was about 15. You know, I was writing teenage angsty stuff then and political stuff and what have you. Didn't really write through my 20s, 30s. I had ideas, I scribbled ideas. I'm not poems, bits of film ideas and song ideas. And I was 39. You used to get City Life, didn't you? City Life was great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because... like you're bored on a Tuesday, you'd look at the music page, then you'd look at the theatre page, then you look at the jazz page and the folk page, and you'd see what was on. So there's always a spoken word page, a literature page, and I used to look at it thinking, you know what, I need to take these poems into town. And there was a night happened above the Britain's Protection Day, you know, a little room above the BP Per Verse it was called. A guy called Conor Aylward ran it. And I went down, and my mum was very ill at the time. My mum was given... she was given a fortnight to live, and she lived about 10 years. She was really, really ill, you know. She was in hospital for months at a time. I wanted to say, you know, them poems I had at home, Mum, I took them into town and people thought they were all right. And that's what happened. My mum saw me get a certain way with it, excuse me. And I went along, and, you know, some amazing poets in Manchester. Some of them were a couple of years in front of me at it. Some of them were only a few visits in front of me. People like Jackie Hagan would be there and Mike Garry would be there. And people like a guy called Shaggy Lee French and Michelle Green and these people, they were, you know, bloody good by any measure. Chloe Poems, really good stuff, but accessible and urban and what have you.
And gritty.
Gritty, all that. But just funny as well, clever, all of those things.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, I want to have a good go at this. So it was like, come back next month. And I wrote a couple more, come back next month. About 3 or 4 months in, he's right, you got a feature slot next week. And that was 2004, three or four. And the next summer, I talked myself into Glastonbury Poetry Stage, you know, and I was away.
And you've been full-time pretty much since 2011.
Yeah, so that was about 2004. And I started meeting people. There's not many people make a full-time living at poetry. I started meeting people who were. And, you know, I had two kids at the time, you know, mortgage. And it was a big decision. About 2007, I started getting a couple of decent paydays, schools and conferences and a bit of a commission and that. And I thought, you know, if I could live on a single wage, I'd be okay. But then 2011, I was getting, you know, more exciting offers. And I worked in local government and that wasn't going great if you think back then and what was coming. So I had 18 years service in, so there's a decent little redundancy check there. So I was saying to my wife, and it was somewhere on the brave to foolish axis, at the foolish end, you know what I mean? And she just come downstairs on Saturday morning, God love her, and said, you know what, if this is like The Simpsons, there's a moment in every marriage, you know that? He's like, go with me here, love, you know? And she come down and said, you know what, I can see it's eating you up, this. If you want to have a go at it, let's give it a couple of years. We won't starve and see where it goes and this works out.
Never look back. So everything changed for you completely the day after the Manchester Arena tragedy, 22nd of May 2017. Yeah. That day, people outside Manchester didn't really know the name Tony Walsh, but within 24 hours, 48 hours, your name became synonymous with what was going on in the city. Who was it who suggested that you should read out that poem, This Is The Place, at the vigil the night after the attack?
Yeah, thanks for that, Clint. I started getting texts the next day. I was working in a school in Warrington and we'd all seen the news at night. I watched it with my daughter, and, you know, 17. We were worried that she'd have friends there. And the next day, I didn't want to properly watch the news. I didn't want to take it in when I was working with kids, you know. And about lunchtime, I started getting tweets from people I knew worked around Richard Leese in the leader's office. I knew what it would be. I phoned him on my dinner. Can you come and do this poem? And a fella called Steve Michio had died just a few months before, and just a few weeks before, there'd been a memorial service for him at the cathedral. So he used to be my boss 20 years ago when I worked for the council, and he became very senior in the council and then very senior in the health service in Manchester, and he died in his early 60s. And there'd been a memorial service for him at the cathedral. And Steve had my poem framed on his desk. He'd seen it a few years before.
Because it's 4 years before.
Yeah, it was written about 3 or 4 years for the, you know, excellent charity Forever Manchester. So all the great and the good had heard me do it at Steve Mitchell's memorial service a few weeks before. So when that happens, it's like, who's going to say what here? I didn't want it to be overly political or over religious. And it's you know, get that poet guy down, you know.
And who was it who made the call then?
It was Richard's office, Sir Richard's office.
Right, okay.
You know, and it's 18 months later and, you know, let's remember what it was about, you know, 22
absolutely,
people killed, young people were killed.
A few personally, I mean, it affected everybody massively in this city, some people more than others, obviously, but for you, it must have been a bittersweet thing that suddenly the world knew you and your words and your talent, your skill, but it came out of such a dark chapter of the city's history.
It was hard, and it still is hard, and I feel that responsibility, you know, really strongly. So my way of giving that back has been using the poem to raise money for local causes, and it's raised about, you know, getting on for £200,000 now.
Absolutely amazing.
So within a few weeks of the bomb, the artistic community came together and said, can we interpret the poem in a design way to raise money? So of course I said yeah, and I can take very little credit for this, but a guy called James Torrey, who runs an animation company, a guy called Mark at Glorious Creative, came together, curated this beautiful hardback book with 61 lines in the poem and different artists, creative in Manchester, taking a page each. So Peter Saville came on board very early. Kevin Cummings came on board very early. Stanley Chow, people will know. Central Station Design, he did all the Monday stuff, came on. And he made this beautiful thing. They sold it for £30 a piece before last Christmas. Waterstones didn't take a penny. Amazon didn't take a penny. Nobody took a penny. And that raised £150,000 just short off. And that went three ways: to the bomb fund, to Forever Manchester, and to the homeless charity. And a few other people have licensed it since, and that's all going back, you know.
You must have felt a lot of weight on your shoulders at that moment in time. I can understand that. But to your credit, the fact that you along with people like Andy Burnham, both the Gallagher boys, Noel for writing Don't Look Back in Anger, and Liam for the way he came back and did the One Love gig, and Ariana Grande for coming back to the city so soon. You become one of those individuals that really will always represent the way that Manchester showed, this is the way we're going to deal with it, this is how we're going to start
I think Manchester can be very proud of that. You know, let's not over-egg it. Some of what happened was just a human response that would have happened everywhere, just a basic, respectful, dignified response. But I do think we singled ourselves out with the collectivism of our response and the way we stood together as a whole city and the creativity of it, the way it came out in all sorts of different art forms. It was dance mixes done in my poem and classical mixes. It was projected onto buildings. People have had it tattooed on them.
Yeah.
But, you know, people brought whatever their creativity was to the situation. And, you know, choose love, we stand together, all that stuff, the whole one love thing, the whole be thing. The city's, I think, can be proud of the way it's responded by and large.
And 18 months later, and I'm assuming, like, when you're out and about doing your gigs, you're still expected to do that poem.
Yeah, it surprised me. Well, it's been amazing how deep and how quickly it's been absorbed into the culture. And people do want to hear it. And it's translated outside of Manchester as well, which I didn't necessarily think would happen. Right. People want to hear it outside Manchester. And, you know, I work in schools. I wouldn't have done it in primary schools necessarily, but they know it in primary schools now. They do it off by art. They've done their own versions. There's displays on the wall. So I don't do it all the time. And it's hard to be known for one thing when I've got all sorts of other stuff.
I imagine it's emotionally draining to it. It's not like it, if you're, you know, compared to a musician with, you know, that might be his biggest record.
Yeah.
You're not just reciting a record. It's bringing a lot back to you every time you do it.
It is. And I've only got to say this in a certain way. And people start crying.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And it, you know, the poem's not about the bomb. It's a pride poem for Manchester, and people overlay things onto it. And, you know, as an artist, it's about connection, isn't it? So the fact that something's connected that deeply and broadly and profoundly for those reasons for people, it will always be a privilege, and I can't be churlish about that in any way.
And when Noel Gallagher wrote Don't Look Back in Anger, he wasn't thinking about the arena tragedy.
No, and you know, Noel's on record saying, can I have my song back, please, in some ways, because of what it means to him.
Yeah.
But, you know, Noel and Liam have done the right thing by that track. And again, you've got to be proud when your work connects that way with people.
And Noel took you to U2, didn't he, a couple of years ago? Is that right?
Yeah, I've knocked about with Noel a few times. We share an Irish council house Manchester background, you know what I mean? And we have a good chat about that. I was in Manchester a couple of weeks ago and U2 were on. And he asked me and my missus down and we met him at his hotel and got the got the limo into the back of the gig there. He just watched it from with the public, stood up in the arena there. People were coming up to him, you know, every 30 seconds, and he was very gracious right through the show. Yeah. It was an amazing gig.
And did Bono, did he mention your name or did he sing it or something?
He did. When I first met Noel, he told me that he tweeted my poem to Bono on the day of the vigil. Who's this guy? I don't know. And so when seeing you two were on, I said to Noel, yeah, can you get us in here, like, to meet him and that? And he says, I do better than that. You can come with me. Because he was in town to see City in the day. And so he gets backstage and that, and I sent a copy of my book properly into the dressing room to Bono. And a guy come out and said, oh, he's telling them all in there about your poem. Oh, wow, blimey. So we're watching a gig, and about four songs in, they do Beautiful Day. You know, it used to be Match the Day theme tune. It's a beautiful
day. That's right, yeah, yeah.
And he sings it. And apparently he does this everywhere he goes. There's a point in it where he changes the words. So he goes, see the world in green and blue, with the Longfellow right in front of you.
Oh,
and I thought, did that just happen? And his oppo there was behind me, put his hand on his shoulder, goes, did you hear that? He said he was going to do that. I was like, wow, that's quite something, that.
Pretty amazing, that, isn't it? Have you got a recording of it?
I have, yeah. Of course, these days, it's all over YouTube, isn't it?
So, good on.
I'm having that.
Let's talk about Manchester. That's one of the things that I'm talking to on everyone's podcast. One of the things I'm asking my guests is to try and define the spirit of your average Mancunian or the spirit of the city. Do you think we have got a unique sort of spirit in this part of the world?
There's something here, isn't there? Because things happen here that don't happen anywhere else. You know, and by any measure, it's not a big city, is it? And the city centre isn't big. If you think, you know, I always say from Castlefield to the Academy to the Apollo to the Arena, there's your four corners.
You've walked around.
And it's only, a mile and a half on a diagonal. And what has happened here and what continues to happen here is incredible by any measure. So there must be something in the air, something in the water. It's a working class city by and large, and something comes from that. It's a diverse city and always has been. There's a lot of Irish heritage here, a lot of Italian heritage here, going back here, people from the West Indies, from Africa now, and Asia and what have you. So that, I think that melting pot, that cross-fertilisation helps. I think the weather's got something to do with it. You know, we're only here as a city because of the weather, aren't we? The damp air helped them spin the cotton. So we moan about the weather, but we're all here because of it.
It defines us, doesn't it?
And then it feeds off itself then, doesn't it? You do well to find where it comes from, but then there's such a momentum here that it's in the air, you can plug into it. Everyone knows someone who knows someone, you know.
And as a poet, you've got a world of material just right outside your doorstep. And you could make a career out of the next 30, 40 years just writing poems about things you should see in Manchester.
Yeah, and there's a great poetic tradition here as well, on all different, you know, poetry's as broad as music. So, you've got Caroline Duffy here, the outgoing poet laureate.
Yeah.
You know, you've got all sorts of academic poets here, great writing skills at MMU and the university. You've got poets coming at it from a rap side of thing, from an urban side of thing. You've got people coming from working class thing. You've got punk poets, you've got reggae poets, folk poets.
Yeah.
So we've got an amazing literary and poetic tradition here as well.
It's a great thing, isn't it? What are your favourite places in Manchester then? Like hanging out places, places to walk, places to eat?
I live just by Eaton Park, me. So I'm always in Eaton Park. You'll see me knocking about in there. I do like a pork bun from there's a little bakery in Chinatown just by the arches there, by the arch there called Ho's Bakery. It's like Greg's, but it's Chinese. You know what I mean?
Oh,
Chinese savouries. I'm often in there. I like to try and keep up. I don't go back to the same place a lot. I like to check out the new places. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do like eating out in town. You know.
Do you still get to any gigs?
I do, yeah. I get to a lot of festivals, you know, with my poetry, and then I check out, see the bands there, and I check out those guys when they come in town. I've seen the Slow Readers Club a good few times over the last couple of years. We just mentioned them before. And when the Central Library here reopened, you know, the big round library, and Slow Readers were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, they performed, I introduced them. So it's been great to watch those lads get on bigger and bigger stages, and they've sold out the Apollo before Christmas, haven't they?
Oh, it's amazing. They've got
a big classic stadium sound, haven't they?
Yeah.
And good luck to them.
And it's one of those sounds that it's internationally loved, isn't it, that sound? So there's no reason why they can't go and smash it all.
Yeah, they really can. Good luck to them.
What do you think about the way that Manchester's developing architecturally in recent years?
It's interesting. There's some great new buildings, and there's some great new quarters. There's some stuff that's less than great, you know. We're losing some of our old buildings, which is a shame sometimes, particularly when they're of architectural merit. You know, not everything is, it might be old, but isn't necessarily of, you know, listed status or architectural status. It was a shame to lose the Odeon, I think, the heritage of the Odeon as an iconic building. And you can't preserve cities in Aspic. It's the way of things that things move forward, isn't it, you know?
And hopefully they'll get the balance right. And
I wouldn't like to make them decisions.
Dave Moutrie was saying a similar thing, that he appreciates the architectural, you know, the brilliance of it, but he wishes that there's more social housing being put up in the city.
Absolutely. And, you know, I worked in social housing for 20 years, and, it, you know, it saved my life, literally, going back to what we were talking about at the start. And, you know, we're here in the city centre, here in Spinningfields. There's a lot of money about in there, you know.
Yeah.
In every sense, in every way. But, you could throw a tennis ball from here into Salford, into Hume, into Miles Platting. And those are some of the most deprived communities in the country, aren't they?
Yeah,
and, you know, we need to keep the balance right.
What's coming next for you work-wise? And you're doing some touring, I believe. And you got another book coming out?
All sorts. This last 18 months, 2 years have been so crazy that it's put some of the publication side of things on hold, so I've got a backlog of things to get out. There's a thing called Digital Kids happening, a kids sort of gaming tech conference. I've got a new book out. My lad was into Minecraft. I wrote a Minecraft poem.
All right.
Hooks up with a Minecraft specialist. So we're talking about putting the poem in Minecraft, but there's a book of that in the meantime. I've got a thing on at Heaton Park and the RNCM. I've worked with a classical director and composers, and I've written some World War One stuff linked to Heaton Park. That's been arranged by top conductors and sung by classically trained singers and music people.
Because Eaton Park, is that where they did a lot of the
training?
The rehearsals for what was going to happen in World War One
and World War Two, Amazing history in there. And then my second full collection is much delayed. I'm going to put that out next spring. It's going to be called Work-Life Balance, but with three full stops, poems about work, poems about life, poems that offer some sort of balance. So I'm going to tour that nationally in the spring. I've got a Manchester gig that we just booked. Between now and then, I've nearly sold out Bury Met on December the 12th. If people are quick, they might get tickets there. And giving it a good go next year, touring my new book and see where it goes.
Yeah.
Bits of telly stuff on the go.
Who's your football team?
Well, it's interesting. I grew up a United fan, and I wrote the official tribute when Alex Ferguson left United.
Right.
I brought a tear to his eye. But City wanted my This Is The Place poem. We let them put it in the dressing room, and they made a big donation to Forever Manchester. So I'm a United fan, and my poem's up in the City dressing room at the minute.
If I was said to you, Tony Walsh, who are your favourite humans of Manchester, past or present? Give me two or three names.
Oh, blimey. Now you're asking. You've got to take your hat off to people on the design side and the photography side. So you're coming up with names like Peter Saville. You're coming up with names like Kevin Cummins, you know, those sort of people. Malcolm Garrett doesn't always get name checked in that company, but, you know, Malcolm did all the early Buzzcock stuff. Yeah. Professor of Design now, those sort of people. You know, people don't always mention Roger Eagle the way they should. Owned and ran the International, massive part of the Stone Roses story. I saw the Stone Roses International one.
Yeah.
And he goes right back to the Northern Soul thing, you know. You put me on the spot here, Clint. That's got to be a long list there. You've got Manchester District Music
Archive. It won't be as long as Rowetta's.
Was it not? Yeah, if you give me some prep, I'd have thought this through better. But you've got Manchester District Music Archive, if people don't know about that. It's an amazing thing. It's an online museum. So you go on there, and every Manchester band artist ever, going back 150 years, has got a page. Every club ever, every record shop has got a page. And then people upload their memories, they upload their artifacts, their old posters, their old stories, their old tickets, T-shirts, all that. And it's got every venue there. So that means that also everyone who's been through town gets a mention.
Yeah.
So there used to be some sort of cave in Stockport cut into them red cliffs. And yeah. Jimi Hendrix played there. So if you want to know about when Jimi Hendrix played in a cave in Stockport, that's the place to go.
It's MDMA, Manchester District Music Archive. Was it Dave Rolfe that started it?
Dave Rolfe was involved, and yeah. CP Lee, who's somebody else we could mention, Chris Lee. And Alison Surtees and Matt Norman, Abigail Ward. It's an amazing thing. If you're into your music, then you'll click on there and you'll just lose a week and a half.
It's almost like a Wikipedia. It's like a part Wikipedia, part Facebook page, which is all about Manchester's music.
If you've got stories, if you've got stuff in drawers, old flyers, old tickets, old photos, then get on there and upload them. And if the artist or the venue you're on about isn't there, then you can create that page. It's great.
Fantastic. Right, final thing, Tony. Describe Manchester in three words.
Can I have four?
You're going to say this is the place.
You know what? I wasn't good at it. There we go. I can have to do an apostrophe. No, this is place.
It's place. This is place.
This is the place. There we go. There's four. I'll have four.
I wouldn't have expected anything else from you, mate. Tony Walsh, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Cheers, Clint. Thanks for having me.
There you go. That was Tony Walsh. Make sure you join me next week, where I'll be speaking to the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Mr. Andy Burnham. And don't forget to follow us on social media. We are at HumansExcess. And subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester, rate us, and feel free to leave us a comment. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.